Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. We're going to go back today to section Dalet, which we skipped over in the season a couple of weeks before Pesach that we were learning. And it's an extremely unusual agarata. And an extremely unusual agarata. The Gemara in Bava Metzia Daf Pei Dalet. The Gemara tells as follows. Kiavumikli Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon Vahadi Adadi. When Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon would bump into each other, would meet each other, and would be talking to each other, have a ayil bakri deturi beinayev ulei havenagavahu. A pair of cattle would walk between them and would not touch them. What does that mean? Explains Rashi. Mitoy mechmas kreisan, mitoy shekreisan gadol. They were very, very large people. And so when they stood facing each other, each one had a large belly, and they protruded, and they bumped into each other. So that this was, you know, they were, their heads were over here where my thumbs are, their stomachs were over here, and there was a nice little place underneath. So you could have had the Gemara's, presumably speaking in exaggerated terms, but I was saying a pair of cattle could have walked underneath and wouldn't have touched them. Even though they were mamish, you know, facing each other as close as they can get. Says the Gemara, Amar lehu hayi matronisa b'necham enam shalachem. So there was this matronisa, there was this important Roman woman who chepped them. And she said, your children can't be yours. Because they figured that they could not possibly have been able to be intimate because they were so large. So he said, they said to him, Shalahen, Gadol Mishalanu. They said, if you think we're big, you should see our wives. They're even bigger than we are. Says the Gemara. What? Says the Gemara. Says the Gemara. Kol Shekain. Says the Gemara. So, you know, so how much more so? So, you know, what are you going to say? Si'ika de Amri Hachi Amrula. Some say this is what they said to her as an answer to the question. Ki ki'ish givurasei. To each man, corresponding to the man, would be givurasei, would be his strength. Meaning, the way simply it's understood is that, okay, yeah, we have this big stomach which gets in the way, but we also have, therefore, as the men, we have the ability to go beyond. Kodesh Baruch Hu equipped us to be able to pass through that difficulty, to be able to overcome that difficulty. Ikodi Amri, alternatively, they said, Achi Amrula, Ava Dechekes Es HaBosar. Love will push aside the flesh. In other words, by the act of the consummation itself would be able to push aside and make it possible to overcome. Says the Gemara, "V'lam luhula adurila." Says the Gemara, "Why do they have to respond to her?" "V'ksiv altan kesil kavlo." So you don't have to respond to the ksil, to the fool, according to their mistakes. Says Gemara, "Shaloi lo haitzi lazal b'neihem," because they did not want that these aspersions should take root, and people would say that their children must not be theirs, because the question which she posed, right, was one which would create all kinds of negative rumors and repercussions. So therefore, that's why they felt that in this situation, it was necessary to respond. And the Gemara goes on, right? And seemingly this is an expansion on what the Gemara said, that kiki ishkivu rasai, which means that we were equipped to overcome it. And the Gemara said, Eiver de Rishmel Brabyesi kechamas bas teisha kabin. The Eiver, the organ of Rabbi Shmuel Brabyesi, who was one of those two personalities who's mentioned before, was like a chemas, like a canteen, which a container, bas teisha kabin, that would hold 9 kav, right, large. Amar Rav Papa, Ebered Rav Yechon, kechamas bas teisha kabin. Right, this was Rav Yechon's commentary about Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yosi. So Rav Papa says about Rav Yechon that he was five kabin. His was five kabin. And some say three kabin. And about Rav Papa, they said, Rav Papa was one who commented on Rav Yechanan, they said, ki dikure de harpanoi, like a certain basket of harpanoi. Says the, so that's the Gemara. Very, very, very strange. Very strange that the Gemara should speak about this, that the Gemara should discuss this. Taisvis says, Eilu dvorim nichtavu, shiloi lohaitzi lazal bnei adam shem kach. Why were these written? So that people would not cast aspersions on people who were like this. Whether cast aspersions on the children, like the first story of the Gemara, or if somebody is seen to perhaps be, have oversized, that wouldn't be considered to be, oh boy, you know, he must be a terrible person, because you see this about these outstanding personalities. But what on earth is this talking about, right? Is that enough, right? The Maral, you know, Taisvis explains, but Taisvis, he says, very interesting thing, which we find the Maral says in different places about different Rishonim, says sometimes they're just explaining the Gemara simplistically for those who would be only ready to read the Gemara simplistically, right? And that, you know, this was just all they can take. So to them, you know, as he says, Taisvis wrote it for those who can't understand the profundities of wisdom. But the truth is that what the Gemara is saying is far more profound. However, it's saying it in very, very, very difficult terms. So, what does this mean? So the Maral says, I want to just note for you, by introduction, something that you should notice in the Gemara. When it lists this string of people and says, oh, this one, his aver was this large, and then the next one, right, these were all, as we point out when we read it, these were all the same people talking about each other. But all of them were subject to it. And they were talking about, you know, this one was talking about that one, and then there was a comment about that same one. They were all in this league of discussing this issue, of experiencing this issue. And he says, secondly, what we find is that it gets smaller from generation to generation. Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi was before Rabbi Yechanan. Rabbi Yechanan was before Rav Papa. Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi was described as being larger, Rabbi Yechanan smaller, Rav Papa smaller than that. So what's going on over here? What's the idea behind this Gemara? Says the Maral, something which is, you know, we'll do his opening salvo here in explaining it, is the clearest and the easiest, and I think when we hear it, we'll realize that it's the most sort of direct hit on the Gemara, in a positive sense, in terms of explaining the Gemara. Gamzam l'chved Hashem Yisbarach. He says this Gemara is also, believe it or not, to honor and glorify Hashem. Ki arbei mechachamim ve'im achaykrim v'sichlam ala nimtzoyim she'im ayimrim ki zeh cherpas ha'odom u'boshtrim klimas le'chibur ishim ishtem. Says people say, the wisest of them will say that this area, the area of the intimate encounter, is cherpas ha'odom u'boshtrim. It's the shame of man. It's something which needs to be associated with shame. It's shameful. It's sinful by its essence, by its nature. Ad she'amru v'haskama muchletes, until they said with absolute consensus, and he's referring here to the Aristotelians and the rest, chush ha'mishush cherpo hulanu, that chush, that sense of touch, which is, in a broad sense, what this refers to, is cherpo hulanu. It's the shame of man. That's what the Chachamim here are coming to say the opposite of. And you think about it. If you were reading this Gemara, huh? Again, what? I didn't hear the first word you said.
It's a Christian.
Yeah, like Christian. Right. Right, right. It's sinful. And a holy person will be completely, you know, abstaining. Right? The monastic life. So he says, that's why the Gemara is sitting here, and the Gemara is talking about it. And that's why the Gemara is talking about it and saying that the greatest sages of the greatest of the greatest generations. Oh, with them, this aver, this organ, was extremely, extremely large and strong. And yeah, as time went on, maybe it got weaker. But just like we always view that the sages got weaker, and there was a lowering of the generations that way. So there was a lowering of generations in this realm as well. But what they're doing is, they're saying, don't view it as something that is by its essence shameful, that's by its essence distance. You're uncomfortable when I'm reading to you this Gemara. Says, well, that's exactly the point of the Gemara. That's exactly the point of the Gemara. In other words, you know, it's like this, there's a notion called exposure therapy, right? What does that mean? What's exposure therapy? If a person has a very, very difficult time with something they can have, a person can have an obsession, a terrible obsession with something, right, with a specific thing. Let's say a person's very, very obsessed with cleanliness. So sometimes the exposure therapy would say, okay, you know what? They're going to take the person who's here. Want to have you, you know, go put your hands here in this dirty place, right? And then you can't wash them. Can't wash them for 6 hours. Why? Because you'll see it's not going to kill you, right? In other words, sometimes a person feels, I have to do this. Go ahead, let's go, we're going to put it in front of you, and you'll see that you don't have to, that it's not going to be the end of the world. And that way, the person comes to understand it. Says the Maharal, when Chazal are coming here, and speaking about this amongst our greatest, what they're trying to say is, Shem Tzachnisht. Don't be ashamed, don't say, oh, our sages had to have been monks. No, that's not the case. This chush, this sense, this faculty of the person is not cherpalanu, is not shameful for us. That's the outline. That's what I say. Now, that's the first thing of the Maharal. Now we're going to talk about it a little bit more. He's going to deal a little bit more with some of the details, the nuances, and the flow of the Gemara. We're going to spend the bulk of our time just talking about the core principle, which the Maharal is saying over here, which I think is a very, very direct hit, you know, direct way to speak about the Gemara. It makes you uncomfortable, that's your problem. Right? That's your problem. The problem is because we have, not your problem, our problem, because we have something of a distorted view of what this is, and therefore we say, oh my gosh, couldn't be. And therefore, Chazal are trying to tell us, no. See the other part of it. See the other part. Now, you know that there's a history and a basis for this. And, in a certain sense, right? I'm not an expert in Christian theology, but the Christians get, you know, this notion from their own reading of the same Chumash which we have, and the Chumash which we have does say that after Adam and Chava sinned, so they ran and they went to cover their private parts of their body, and that there was a matter about which suddenly there was busha, there was shame, and which would seem to, again, to some degree substantiate some kind of a consideration. On the other hand, remember that Adam and Chava, before they sinned, they were not ashamed. And the question is, which one is a greater indication of the reality? Is the greater indication of the reality the fact that they were ashamed of it after they sinned? Or was the greater indication of the reality the fact that they weren't before? Says the Maharal, two principles, two bases for saying that necessarily, we must say that the first one is the ideal condition. Says, first of all, you know, the Rambam starts this guide for the perplexed, the Mor Nevuchim, by asking a question. He says, tell me something. It says that when man would eat from the tree of knowledge, then his eyes would be opened, and they'll be like God who would know good and evil. Says the Rambam, that's like saying, I don't want you to do this. Don't you dare do this. Don't you dare take anything from there. If you do, you're going to become the most brilliant, wise, intelligent person that exists in the world. Right? I mean, you know, they would sin, and as a result of sin, they would become like God, knowing good and evil. I mean, that sounds like a pretty good result, right? All sins should have such wonderful results. So what's going on? Right? So the Rambam goes on to explain, you know, with his own explanation, that the idea was that indeed, before that, they had a different kind of a knowledge, and now their knowledge was going to be changed and downgraded. Before, their knowledge was much, much more sharp and clear. They knew things as true or false, which is much more sharp and clear than knowing things as good or bad, right? Because good or bad can equally refer to, stealing, as it can refer to chocolate ice cream, right? Chocolate ice cream, somebody might say it's good, somebody might say it's bad. Stealing, somebody might say it's good, somebody might say it's bad. The earth is flat, a person wouldn't say that it's bad. A person would say it's dead wrong, right? It doesn't even begin. So therefore, that's the way the Rambam understands. It was a downgrading of the wisdom of the person to not see things with the same clarity, with the same kind of absolute and vivid clarity than how one would see things before. But the bottom line, says the Maharal, again, however you're going to interpret, however you're going to translate, what we're going to say is that the person before the chet, before the sin, was certainly in a more idealized state than the person after the sin. And if before the sin there was no busha, there was no shame associated with this area of his self and of his body, so then that tells you that that's really the ideal description and the ideal condition in which and through which this should be viewed. That's number one. And number two, says the Maharal, another argument, which is a very, very interesting, profoundly interesting and important argument, says the Maharal, Kilo yizbol davar ze adas, and this is really the first argument which he makes in his presentation. He says, there's no way that the mind could tolerate this. Ki ye yisod hakol asher ukiyum ha'olam shupiri v'rivya, that the foundation of everything, that which keeps the world going, i.e., piri v'rivya, being fruitful and multiplying, ye nivna al dvo davar genai v'cherpa, it should be something that by definition is shameful. Right? That which it says, oh, Hashem didn't create the world to be empty. He created the world for it to be inhabited. From which we learn the greatness, that we call it a mitzvah rabbah, pru'urvu, to be fruitful and multiply. So we're going to call that something which is shameful? We could say that Hashem left his world to be built on something which is absolutely and utterly shameful? How could it be? Why should Hashem, the perfect creator, make something that is so flawed that in order for it to continue, you have to have something which the truth is you should be ashamed of?
Doesn't make sense.
Right. You know, somebody told me a very, very, very good idea. He says, many faiths have arisen over time that felt that the way that the proper adherence to that faith is for a person to live a monastic life. For some reason, those faiths only lasted like basically one generation. Correct. So the idea that in order to be able to have continuity, in order to be able to have perpetuation, in order for the world to continue to exist, that you'd have to resort to something which is a compromise, which is a negative thing, is just, says Maharal, it's intolerable logically to see that in the world. How could it possibly be that way? How could we accept and absorb this very negative view of the whole thing?
It's very interesting that there was a Roman major who was approaching. If you go to Pompeii, for example, I don't know if anyone's been to Pompeii, there was a vibrant Jewish community in Pompeii. So it was small, it was a very successful commercial town. But in Pompeii itself, you know, the Romans had the organ on their doors. It was a common feature of that society. Just like we have mezuzahs, that's what you find. You go to the museum. Absolutely. You go to the museum in Naples, and there are walls for them. Because they took out from Pompeii, from the doors, this particular item.
And what was the rationale for that?
I think it certainly wasn't Jewish thinking. I think the Romans were amoral people. Okay? And And you go to Pompeii and you wonder how these Jews could survive being assaulted by this all the time.
That's incredible. I never heard that in my life. That's
absolutely
incredible.
You see it, and you go to the museum in Naples, and they have walls like that.
Unbelievable.
Symbol of procreation.
Procreation, but also a symbol of sexual vibrancy. And it was the common item.
Yeah.
It was the rule, not the exception. In Pompeii.
I like on the museum.
And just like we have, they have open doors.
I mean, the Gemara speaks about it as there was an idol, which was made that way. And in fact, you know, right, Mifletzes, in the time of the Tanakh, the Gemara says that by one of the mothers of the kings, of the Malchi Yisrael, of the Israelite kings that were completely absorbed in Avodah Zarah, she made something called Mifletzes for Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says what it was an image of the organ. And she was she used it on herself, and the Gemara describes that, and it's to some degree an understanding of the Avodah Zarah of Baal. Right? Baal means, you know, the husband. The act of relations is referred to as being Boel, right? That's the verb for that. So there's some hint to that in a much much earlier period than the period of the Romans. I never heard that. Oh my gosh. Wow, 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 wow. Okay.
It's a shocker when you say it, but the guys will tell you that very just off the cuff. That's what it
was. Okay. Yeah. Even after learning this maral, we're going to stick to the mezuzah. Now. When you think about it, so again, his two major points are: number one is that it would not be from external logic that Hashem should make his world dependent on something which is inherently shameful is not possible. And he says, and furthermore, the way he brings it is, you know, what we brought as the first argument: that's clearly, if you look at the Torah, you'll see the same thing, because in man's original state, which was the more idealized state, there was no shame associated with this at all. And it's impossible to say that man, you know, became more attuned and more sensitive and more realizing the truth after he ate from the Eitz Hadas, because the Eitz Hadas is clearly a step down. So he says. Now let's pause for a moment. Now, we believe this, and we practice this. Because while we don't do this, you know, what you just described, having had such an image on our doorpost, but you know that one of the most joyous public celebrations of Jewish life is a bris. Right? And it was the two mitzvahs which the Jewish people have sort of like as the, you know, sort of like baseline commitments of Jewish life would be B'damai chayi, b'damai chayi. Right, the two mitzvahs of the blood, so to speak, the mitzvah of the bris milah and the mitzvah of the seder of korban pesach, those two which are bound up with each other, the two mitzvahs that say sheyesh b'hem karas, the only two positive commandments in the Torah that failure to fulfill them brings a person the drastic consequence of karas, so to speak, being cut out from his people. So there's like sort of like this instinctive thing in the Jewish people that has perpetuated these. Now, if you think about it, it's a rather remarkable thing. Here we go. We're going to get everybody together in the shul. And we're going to go up to the bima, right, where the Sefer Torah is read. And we're going to go and we're going to do a circumcision on a child. I mean, wouldn't this be a better thing to happen in an OR, you know, or in a doctor's office someplace, you know, without videos? You know, I mean, could you imagine? You know, what's the idea? And it's more than that. It's even more than that. Because if you think about it, the truth is you're not allowed to make a bracha in the presence of uncovered flesh, of the private, of that which is supposed to be covered. Pasuk teaches us that you have to keep a privacy, you have to keep a tznius around these areas, around these things. Let it not be seen otherwise, because that can't be there with the presence of Hashem. What do you do with a bris? You know, there is an opinion that when the time when the male makes the bracha, the father makes the bracha, it should be covered. But we don't hold like that at all. Farkert. It's out there in the open. It's out there in the open. And in a sense, right, the idea is because the bris milah, the fact that the covenant between Hashem and the Jewish people is inscribed on that place, on that aver, is because we are saying, no, don't tell me this is out of it. This is in it. This is going to be very, very much to forge the connection between Hashem and the people. And while one might say, oh, easy to say by a child, because the child, maybe the erva of a child, is not considered to be an erva. And in halacha, we would say that to some degree. But there's something much more to it. The whole mitzvah of bris, the whole celebration of the covenant in that area is, again, like this, excuse the pun, but what we said before, the sort of exposure therapy. That we're making it very, very clear that this is to be included. Don't view this as the devil. Don't view this as something which is necessarily outside of the realm of shame. Delicately, specifically, we are very, very much going to be including it. We are going to be talking about it and putting the imprint of the relationship of Hashem with Hashem there specifically. So what's the idea? What's the pshat? And why is it that then suddenly it becomes an instrument of shame? Why after the sin, however, right, which is where we're living, right? We're living after the sin, so Adam had to cover it up. Aval inenu shomarnu. Kein chisus ha'inen ze klal mitzad atzmo. He says the idea itself, the relation itself, is not in itself flawed, is not in itself considered to be weak or sinful. Rak bishvil sha'adam mechaving l'tavosa v'yitzrei. U'mitzad hazeh hadavar hu genai. But the issue is that we engage in it, perhaps, with just simply a lustful attitude. So that is going to affect it, that is going to color it. Oy, but if we could only do it right. If it could only be done, mitzad ha'kedusha, if it could only be done in the right way, it would be something which would be in that way perfect and not a matter of shame whatsoever. I try to think of it this way. Ramban writes when he explains the accomplishment of the Eitz Hadas, and many really almost all the interpretations of it really come to the same place. They use very different methods of articulation, but they come to the same place. The Ramban says that before the Chet, man was sort of this objective kind of a being that did that which was right because it was right. He did not do things because of a personal drive, because of a drive of the body, of an interest. Imagine if you sat down to the table to eat, that you did it in the same way that you pull up your car to a gas tank. Right? You have this little gauge, right, in your eye, right? And when it starts dipping down below, you know, my wife says I fill up the car when it hits D, you know, instead of it goes from F to E to D. You know, when it's that empty, you go, okay, I gotta put something in. So you go in there and so on and so forth. So, you know, like Amoco advertisements notwithstanding, there's no such thing as appetizing gasoline, right? You know, say, oh, this is clear, you know, the uncola, you know, or whatever it is. You know, you got to put gas in the tank because you know that without it, it's not going to work. Right? So imagine if when you sat down at the table, you did the same thing. Oh, got to put some more fuel in the tank. Got to go eat some more. So what would you do? You'd go and you'd put into your stomach the best possible food for your system. Right? You'd go to the doctor, you'd say, tell me something, what do you suggest? High octane, low octane, broccoli, vegetables, right? You'd say, oh, you know what? That rib steak, you know, dripping with the fried whatever it is, you know, that sure looks good. And you eat it and you know it's not going to be good for you. No, right? You wouldn't be motivated by that. Right? The muscle person, Leleno, has their taste buds get burned, right? He has something hot, his taste buds get burned. Has absolutely no taste buds whatsoever. if he eats a steak, it tastes the same to him as if he eats a chveis cauliflower or whatever else. So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, look, he says, you know, it's your choice. It's your choice. I can give you a reconstructive surgery that'll give you your taste buds back. But then you're going to be tempted by this, you're going to be tempted by that. Alternatively, just stay the way you are. I'll tell you the perfect diet, and you'll never be tempted again. You'll eat the most healthful diet, you know, and it won't even be a challenge. It won't be a problem. And so, what do you choose?
I want the taste buds.
Right? You would say, you know, Shkarach, I'll live. But what do you call this life?
Yeah.
You know? So you would say it. We would say it. But Adam Arishon, before the Chet, right? So, okay, it's not that he didn't enjoy. But enjoyment, right? Farkert, the Ramban himself says that if man before the Chet was said to be immortal, that he would not have died, so then that means even if he wouldn't have eaten, he wouldn't have died. That's what the Ramban understands. He would have just been carried by the eternity of the soul. So he says, you know what eating was for? It would just be a pleasure. Right? Which is very, very interesting. But in other words, it would be a pleasure, and the person would give pleasure to their body, but that would not motivate him in any way to distraction. Huh?
Saying you wouldn't be hungry?
Before the Chet, this is what the Ramban's assumption is. Okay? It's a challengeable assumption. But the Ramban's assumption is that if the soul is not dependent on the body and bodily rules, then a person wouldn't have it either. So he says, Achilu would be Latainu. That's the words of the Ramban. It would be for pleasure. But the idea is that the pleasure did not in any which way constitute a competitive motivation. If there was some right thing to do right now, and by indulging in this pleasure, it would in any way detract from the right thing to do, from the objectively correct thing to do, it wouldn't even figure. But then, when man ate from the Eitz Hadas, and the whole description of the sin of eating from the Tree of Knowledge was, oh, he looked at the fruit, and it was attractive, and it was, you know, and so on and so forth. It was that he wanted to have those taste buds, and he wanted to have a greater degree of interest and excitement. And therefore, with that, he had his own separate motivation. And the motivation was not a lofty motivation. The motivation was a simple physical drive and a simple physical motivation. And that's what man introduced in himself as a competing and present motivation. And because that motivation would very, very much focus as well on this specific area, so therefore, when engaging in that specific area, it wasn't for the lofty and idealistic reasons of ava and of connection that we would have described as being the pure, the objectively pure approach to these issues. But instead it was for much, much more simple, human, pedestrian desires. To the point where, as the Maharal quotes, we find that Chazal would say, even by the greatest of tzaddikim, Yishai, the father of David HaMelech, who the Gemara says elsewhere was one of four people who died only because of the Eitz Hadas. And there was a decree that every person would die. But otherwise, he was such a tzaddik. He was such a pure, righteous man that they couldn't nail him for anything. But at the same time, David HaMelech said, Ki avi v'imi azavuni v'Hashem yasveni, my father and mother would leave me and Hashem would gather me in. That he says, look, you know, when my father engaged in this act, and a big part of the drive was just his own satisfaction. Not because of the idealism and everything else which was involved with it. In other words, the idealism is there. The purity, the idea that this is something to be able to bridge the gap and unify human beings and create another one, it's there. All the Sheva Bracha speeches, they're all there. Except that something else is there too. Now, this is going to be where the Christians and the Jews and this thing are going to part ways. And the Christians are going to say, well, I don't know if there was anything really great that was there to begin with, right? And if there is, at this point it's so contaminated, just forget about it, right? If you want to be pure, you got to avoid the whole thing. And we're going to say, no, there's something holy and there's something pure there. So of course, you have to be careful that you shouldn't become just another animal expressing this desire through this. You have to introduce and include in this as much as possible the elements of the sublime, of the holy, into this. You've got to try to grow it, to make it kiddushin, right? The term which we use for marriage, a sanctification, the highlight and accent and underscore the sacredness of the encounter, as much as you're going to be aware that at the same time there are other things which are going on here. And the person who's going to swallow all the Sheva Brachos drashas and view themselves as being some austere, perfect person engaged only in Shem Shemayim will probably suffer from other delusionary conditions as well. Right? They would be not realizing that, look, you're a human being, this is also going to be part of it. But the fact that it's part of it doesn't make it all of it. And the fact that it's part of it doesn't take away the tremendous, tremendous higher potential and ultimate potential which existed in it and which can potentially exist in it as well at the same time. And that's what we do when we say the Brisa Shel Avraham Avinu. Because what was the first symptom of man actually leaving the relationship with Hashem and not wanting to do simply just which Hashem wanted, to be the perfect malach, the perfect messenger, the perfect servant of Hashem, and instead being pulled away to doing his own thing, right? It expressed itself most strongly in this most primal drive, so to speak, of the person. And therefore, when we want to come back to Hashem, what do? We could try and bring that back. That's exactly it. Right? The Ramchal writes in the Derech Hashem, Adam HaRishon was created, that perfect, that great idealistic human being, he was created with a choice to perpetuate that state or to forsake that state, and he forsook the state. And he was chased out of Gan Eden by Hashem, thrown out of Gan Eden. And now, we got to reclaim it. We've got to reclaim it. But there were two kinds of people in the world. There were the kinds of people in the world who said, ah, we're out of Gan Eden, let's build for ourselves a nice big mansion here. Right? We'll have a golf course and a tennis court in the backyard. And this is it, man. This is now the new life. We're very, very happy here. And then there's another kind of person that says, oh my gosh, I can't believe we were chased out of Gan Eden. How can we get back there? How can we get back there? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was waiting to find the second kind of person who wasn't making himself at home outside of Gan Eden in the lowered state. He was waiting to find the person who would find his way back, and ultimately found only one person. And that was Avraham Avinu. And that was why Hashem chose Avraham Avinu, because Avraham Avinu was trying to claw his way back to Gan Eden. Now we know that Chazal tell us, and we've discussed this Gemara before, and that's the idea that Avram accomplished but didn't complete it. You see, he had a child Yishmael. Yitzchak accomplished but didn't complete it. He had a child Esav, till Yaakov came along. All of his children would be part of the picture. Yaakov Avinu was the one who corrected the sin of the Eitz Hadas. And that mitasei shleima. And that's why the Gemara says that's the idea that Yaakov Avinu didn't die. Right? To some degree, right? He got back the immortality that man had before. But Avraham Avinu was identified as the one trying to find his way back. So what was the expression of Hashem recognizing that and establishing that relationship? What did he do? He gave him the mitzvah of Bris Milah. In the very area which became, so to speak, an area of shame, when Adam HaRishon sinned, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it, let's turn it back into an area of pride, an area of connection between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're going to include this as well. That's also going to be, in a certain sense, in a leading way, it's going to be included in making up the bris between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. And therefore, that's how we celebrate this bris milah, right? Something which, again, to other people from the outside must think we're crazy. They must think it's not much different than the way we're reacting, lahavdil alfafi abdallas, to what Ben is describing amongst the Romans. What kind of a cult is this that you're going to celebrate, that you're going to celebrate things in this way? Right, forget the barbarism, right? But just the exposure that this kind of thing should happen in shul. And that's how the Gemara over here says the Maral is describing that these chachamim, right, that significance was accomplished in this way. Rav Tzadok writes that that the same thing, in a certain sense, in his own way, would be applied to this description of them, that they were so huge and so large, right? That the how could it be? How would you have such a description? You know, you say marba basar, marba rima, right? The Gemara will describe it this way. But again, the whole thing is that there's such a notion of bris basar, that it's possible that the person would be able to somehow do this, create this in a way that would be l'shem shemayim. We're not used to it that way. We're used to it as being something of distraction. We're used to it as being something that, you know, we have to be careful of because it harms life rather than enhances it. In some idealistic way, which I can't explain to you, trust me, I can't explain to you, but in some idealistic way, right, this would be the idea of, as well, of these chachamim with their busser. It wasn't just, you know, that they lost themselves and so on and so forth, but the idea was, again, all a part of this integration of bringing it all with and towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the basic idea. That's the basic thesis which the Maharal is using over here in order to explain this Gemara. And he will go on to deal with, you know, with some of the details, the nuances of how the Gemara presents it, and this idea of, you know, the difficulty that it was able to overcome. Before we do that, anybody, questions or comments?
Christians also are very, very negative about bris milah. They were always asking Chazal about the need for bris milah. If Adam Rishon was so beloved by Hashem, how come he wasn't mal? Big discussion in Bereishis Rabba, 11th chapter. So maybe there's something to that as well. But there's also, they're not only negative sexually, they're also negative against the idea of bris milah.
Correct, 100%. Yes, that is correct, and you know their celebration of it, you know, lack of shame of it, is you know, the erva as is, right? The bris, the mila, you know, the organ as is, without tikkun, just again as a primal urge. Whereas we're understanding that we have to very, very much refine it, that there's a covering on it, right? That is you know, this yetzer and this lust-driven covering on it, and we have to somehow be able to uncover the core connection, which it is instead.
What about B'nai Yishmael? Is it like a Chazar Fiso? Because they do bris because Avram did it, and you know, tikkun for Allah, but yet they're tremendous Balei Taiva.
They're Elam Haba. Think of their description of Elam Haba.
Elam Haba, that they don't get.
Right.
Why did it have to be the private areas covered? I mean, if everything was affected once Adam sinned, like, all our experiences would then be affected by our drives. Again, why couldn't have been our hearing? Why couldn't we all walk around with earmuffs? And
it's a fair question. It's a fair question. There's no question that after all, this becomes, to some degree, the central greatest yetzer, the central greatest area of desire, ultimately, within the human being. And part of it is because of what the Maharal himself pointed out as being sort of like the impossibility of saying that it's a purely negative thing, because it's the creative drive. It's the possibility to be able to be like God, and to be able to build and to develop in that sense. And therefore, in many ways, it is therefore going to be the most difficult urge, the hardest one. At the same time, it's going to be the most profound one. Now, I spoke about this a little bit on Pesach. I think it's a very, very important idea. Everyone is troubled. I shouldn't say it. Let's not start that way. But we read Shir HaShirim on Pesach, the Song of Songs, which is a song of love. It's a song of intimacy, and using it as a metaphor between Hashem and the Jewish people. And we read it Dafkan Chol HaMoed on Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach, or on the Shabbos that comes out on Pesach, however the calendar works. And what we suggested was, because Mitzrayim, a big part of Mitzrayim, right, where the Jewish people didn't have the Bris Milah in Mitzrayim, by and large, except for Shevet Levi, right, but they didn't have the bris mila. Mitzrayim is described, our first real experience with Mitzrayim was that they were shtufei zima, that they were completely, completely absorbed in this lust, right? The story of Avram going down to Mitzrayim, which was our first exposure to Mitzrayim, right? Was that, oh, they see a beautiful woman, they're going to grab her, which is exactly what they did. And Paro himself said, Avram, get out of here. Why does he say get out of here? He says, because look, you know, the people around here, they won't leave you alone, they won't leave her alone, right? So if you better get while the getting is good, right? Just stay away. Time was overwhelmed with Zima, so much so that when Lot and Avram left Mitzrayim, and we know Avram left Mitzrayim with a lot of wealth, but not brought down by the Egyptians, but Lot was very, very much changed. He went to Mitzrayim, and a good, faithful disciple of Avram, he came out from Mitzrayim, and suddenly all kinds of problems developed between him and Avram. And where does Lot choose to live when they have to part ways? To stone, which is characterized with the exact same words. Because they were shtufei zima, because they were overwhelmingly absorbed in lust, he chose to live in their midst. So when we were in Mitzrayim, you could imagine the assault on our feelings, on our senses. We didn't have the bris mila. We must have had a very, very, very distorted, as well, view of this whole thing. And when we come out of Mitzrayim, part of Gulas Mitzrayim is Shir Ashir Masher Lishloimai. Is that we say, view this as the paradigm, the model for the holiest of relationships. Stop viewing it in the gutter. Stop viewing it simply as this lust that drove the Egyptians, and therefore you say, oh gosh, if we want to be close to God, so then, no. We will characterize the potential of the relationship as being something very, very special. And so Chazal tell us that when it came to building the home of Hashem, the Mishkan, what was Hashem's most cherished donation? It was the mirrors, that the copper mirrors, which were used to create the basin, the copper mirrors that the Jewish women used to use, and they used them in order to interest and draw the interest of their husbands. And Hashem said, I love this more than anything else. Because in a sense, what they were doing was, they were again bringing back, so to speak, this healthy intimacy within the Jewish people. It was bringing back this healthy intimacy, and that's the Shir Hashirim, that's Pesach, Mitzrayim, dragged it into the gutter, like our society drags it into the gutter and makes it just seem as, you know, just more, you know, selfish, you know, flesh-based stuff. And instead, right, part of Gulas Mitzrayim is to be able to view it in a more sublime way. Shir Hashirim, like Kodesh Kodashim. The Gemara says Shir Hashirim is Holy of Holies. And what was the image in the Holy of Holies? It was the male and the female angel locked in an embrace. Like that was the Holy of Holies. That was the image, right? So when the Romans conquered the temple, right? When the Babylonians conquered the temple, rather, they said, they went in, they saw them, look at you guys, you have pornographic images in your Holy of Holies. They didn't understand. They saw it like, you know, the pedestrian would read this Gemara that we started with today. But we're insistent on the opposite. Not easy. It's in a hidden place. It's in the Holy of Holies, right? Because, again, the surface, the outer reading of it, right? We still see the all that which hangs around the top of it, which is not stuff that that we're necessarily proud of. But we don't therefore abandon it. Because there's the core of it, the ideal of it, which was great.
Why is it that Chazal encoded this lesson so well? I guess, I mean, the whole Gemara is encoded to a certain extent, but is it just because of the sensitive nature of the topic, or something else?
I don't have an answer beyond your speculation.
What about the intrigue too? You know, you're talking about Adam HaRishon separating himself from the animals. The animals have lust.
Right.
Right. So all of a sudden, he is you know, he sins, and he feels that same loss. But on the other hand, he's told that he is going to be like Hashem, that he's going to know good from evil, which separates him from the animals. On one hand, he's becoming like the animals, and then he's separating himself from the animals. It's hard to you know, integrate that distinction there.
The Yisem Kelekim, Yedei Tevara, is that you will have your own independent desire. When the Nachash, when the snake said you will be like God, he wasn't lying. God is not programmed or defined by anything. He's completely self-motivated. Now his self-motivation may be of purity, of truth, of all the good things, but it's from himself. Nobody imposed it upon him. Adam HaRishon, before he ate from the Eitz HaDaas, wasn't that way. Wasn't self-motivated. Wasn't self-made. His purity was because he had a divinely endowed neshama, which gave him this image. And when he would eat from the tree of knowledge, what he developed more than anything else was a self. He had his own motivation, his own drives. And that means what he would do would be a result of his own choosing, would be a result of his own choice. And that was the godliness which he introduced in himself, in independence. In independence. In fact, the Ramchal explains that the reason why Hashem had to give man free choice and couldn't just make him a beautiful, perfect being and give him all the pleasure in the world was because then he wouldn't be godly. Because to be godly means to be independent. And while a person can independently choose to surrender their independence, right, if you can get your arms around that, and they can independently choose to surrender their independence to Hashem, which is ideally what we are supposed to be choosing to do. But Adam HaRishon instead was made by the Nachash to want to prefer to taste the experience of an ongoing independence, an ongoing ability to choose. And because of that independence, right, he had this part of him which was not godly, right, which was which took over for itself.
Can we be very critical of the Christians? If it was Paul who wrote that, you know, you really have to separate from women, but if you can't, if you're really inflamed, if you really must do this, then go get married. Everybody get, you know, find a wife. Basically what he said.
He even said it was in marriage.
Yeah, he was not the biggest fan, apparently, of marriage, but he was very critical of this whole intimacy thing. And if there's an idea in Chazal that it was the rabbis who actually sent this individual in order to cleave asunder this new cancer within the Jewish people and wanted to get this new thought process out of the Jewish people and make it a whole new religion,
what do you mean that
the rabbis were the ones who sent Saul of Tarsus in a surreptitious way in order to fight them. and they wanted him to create a whole new religion. It was becoming problematic to have these people who were within the Jewish people who were still going to the temple and had their beliefs, but they believed that Jesus was the Messiah. So that had to go. So if the rabbis were the ones responsible for sending this guy in order to drive a wedge between these two faith systems, then my question becomes, should we be very, very critical of that other faith system which we helped develop? We sort of, as the Jewish people, we kind of wanted them out, and he wrote this stuff, and it's clearly not Jewish, but I just was thinking that, you know, we make a big deal about how wrong they are in so many things, but in a way, is it fair to argue that we were kind of responsible for that misleading, wrong thinking? A very long-winded question. I'm sorry, kind of crazy in its way. But I was thinking, you know, we always hock on the Christians, but we were sort of responsible since we sent Paul out and he founded them theologically. Then maybe we shouldn't be so critical of them.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I don't claim to be a scholar of it or whatever. Or the knowing this history about what we did or what we didn't do to, you know, to get them out. But, you know, the ideology was created first. And the question was whether it would be within or whether it would be without. Isn't that the case?
Well, no, I don't know if I agree with that. Jesus certainly didn't speak about these issues to the best of my small reading. It was Paul who actually discussed this, and since he was sent by the rabbis in order to differentiate between those Hebrew Christians, Jewish Christians, and the regular rabbinical Jews, then I'm not quite sure how fair it is when we criticize Christianity, because it was us who sent them there, and he did it.
And
he did his job. He differentiated between the two groups.
Okay. So again, I don't know. I don't feel capable to discuss. But the issue isn't so much to critique this person or that person, but to contrast our, you know, the view that the Torah has with a view which the Torah doesn't have. I don't know that there's any anything to be hesitant or to be ashamed of there. You have to remember that our view of them also, in a certain sense, you know, is the Rambam wrote that the phenomenon of the success of Christianity was because of many things which it did share, and was to introduce the world to notions like Mashiach and things like that, which the world would become familiar with, and therefore be prepared for the ultimate Mashiach, even though they have their own view again of what happened when. But our view isn't going to be wholesale rejectionist or wholesale destructive, but in those areas where we are different and where we must be different and see ourselves as different, we can't blink. No, we can't blink. We have to be very, very clear as to what we believe and what we don't. Okay, Mir Tashem.